the Triathlon Show 283. Up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I'm happy to welcome back Coach David Tilbury Davis. This episode is a bit of a different kind of episode. It's not strictly an interview, more so a discussion where David and I sit down and talk about how coaching and training principles seem to be evolving and things that we've been thinking about. Well, specifically, David has been thinking about them and let me in on that. And then I have started learning about these same things myself. So if you want to pin me down and ask me, well, what is the actual topic of the episode in less vague terms, then I would say that it's about training, learning, and performance frameworks and how they are evolving and evolving from the traditional type of training that has been done in endurance sports. And these frameworks are already used in many other contexts and sports outside of triathlon, but we will talk about how these frameworks can be used in triathlon or generally in endurance sports settings, which hasn't really been talked about much anywhere that I've seen. And we do appreciate that this is a different kind of episode and it won't necessarily be everybody's cup of tea. That's okay. But I think for many listeners, it can be quite eye-opening and a much more unique episode that actually makes you think and reflect about things that you do in your coaching or in your training for that matter. So I hope that many of you will enjoy it and will find it useful. Just a fair word of warning, it may take a little time to digest all of these things and let it sink in. But before we get into the episode, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration. Precision Hydration create electrolyte products that you can use to match your individual sweat sodium concentration. So if you are somebody that loses a lot of sodium, you can get a highly concentrated sodium supplement. And if you are somebody that loses less, then you can use less. And especially as races get hotter and longer, this becomes a crucial part to get right to be able to maintain performance for the entire duration that you will be out there on the race course. But even in training, when you're training, especially at high volumes, and to be able to recover properly from session to session, it can make a difference if you make sure that you don't run too low on your sodium, and having sodium in your hydration is a key part of that. You can get 15% off your Precision Hydration products with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. Today I want to make a product highlight of Roka's trisuit, the Gen 2 Elite Aero Trisuit. The Gen 2 trisuit is designed to provide the optimal balance of aerodynamics, race day function, and premium comfort for triathlons anywhere from sprint to Ironman distance. It has been developed for aerodynamics and thermoregulation in the wind tunnel and out in the real world in the hot conditions of Texas, where Roka is located. They have the arm flap technology that they also have in their wetsuits integrated in the trisuit itself, so that you still retain that same shoulder mobility that you get from the wetsuit arm flap technology, and you don't have your trisuit be the bottleneck for that. And this is a pro tip that I would give to all the listeners. When you're practicing open water swimming, use your trisuit and your wetsuit to make sure that you know that feeling, because on race day you won't be swimming with just speedos or a swimming suit and the wetsuit. You will have your trisuit underneath, so make sure that you're familiar with that feeling, and because it might just be different from using a wetsuit with no trisuit. But I'm happy to say that with the Gen 2 Elite Aero trisuit, that's not a problem at all. It's designed to be perfectly comfortable in the water under the wetsuit as well. You can get 20% off your Roka order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And one more quick piece of housekeeping, just a reminder that until the end of April, we have a launch promo for the newly launched Advanced Olympic 7.3 and Ironman training plans that you can find on scientifictriathlon.com/plans. So they are available until the end of April for 60% off. Go to scientifictriathlon.com/plans to find out more information about that. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this episode with Coach David Tilbury Davis. Today, we have David Tilbury Davis back on the podcast. Hi, David. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Mikael. How are you doing?
Doing good, thanks. For listeners that may not have heard your previous appearances on the podcast, do you mind taking a little minute or two to just give a quick introduction to yourself?
Sure. I've been coaching triathlon for over 25 years now. Worked always with a handful of athletes around the world, mainly individuals that are extremely performance orientated. That doesn't necessarily mean only pros or only age groupers, but I think there's always the mindset has always been the same, whether they're a triathlete or a road cyclist or a mountain biker. And that's really how I've gained all of my coaching experience on, you know, different continents. I've coached in, lived in Spain for some time, coached there, lived in the US for about 6 years, currently live in Finland. You know, over those years, I've coached athletes on 5-6 different continents, you know, different languages. So sort of a broad base of experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for those listeners that may not be aware, and for full transparency, you are also coaching. You're coaching me in my own athletic career. So that's well, we've known each other for quite a long time now, and have been working together for some time as well. And this discussion for today that we have is something that that I think. When did you start learning about it? And can you just briefly introduce the topic?
I think probably a good sort of 6 to 9 months ago, I really started to reframe how I was looking at the sort of development of athletes over the long term, and try and understand the fact that within coaching historically, we've and I talk in the context of sort of endurance sports. We've always come at things in a fairly reductionist way of saying we want to create a certain stimulus X and a different stimulus Y, and the summation of those things should allow a person to then operate in the competitive environment to the best of their ability. And that's become apparent to me as more and more of a supposition, and that actually, whilst in principle it's sound to take that approach, you know, particularly early on in the developmental cycle, as an athlete gets more experienced and higher performing, you know, suddenly you're trying to resolve, you know, increasing the performance capacity of somebody by maybe 1%. And so now, you know, you're not looking for 10 needles in one haystack in terms of physiological developmental tools. You know, you're looking for one needle in 10 haystacks. And there isn't, you know, a right answer for everybody. It's very context dependent on the individual. And that's what's really driven all of this for me. And then also, you know, digging into the physiology as a whole, you know, really starting to compartmentalize things into, you know, how are we actually developing this athlete? You know, are we, you know, concerned with the sort of psychological development aspects, or are we concerned with the sort of central adaptation, so cardiovascular system, or are we concerned with peripheral adaptation in terms of, you know, metabolites and muscle recruitment and those sorts of things. And really trying to understand with each individual athlete that I work with that those things may be different for different athletes. And we've started to see within the coaching sphere this idea that actually, you know, coaching individuals, you know, is about dealing with a complex dynamic system rather than, you know, something that you can, you know, based on sort of SEALs general adaptation to stress theories, you know, you give it a stimulus, you get a response. And yes, you do, but that I think in this day and age of competition is quite a reductionist approach.
So what I'm hearing you say is that basically the traditional approach has maybe been more of you impose a stimulus and you expect that maybe a component of the system will respond in a given way, and that's maybe your objective, and you work on perhaps several different components that you almost assume are independent of each other, and that's been the traditional way and maybe slightly reductionist way, but now you're looking at the individual in a more of a, from a holistic perspective, I guess, and realizing the interdependency between different components and system, whether we're talking about physiology or psychology, and how all those interact, and trying to use that that perspective and that understanding to better develop the athlete. Is that right?
Yeah, and they're not mutually exclusive. I think they sit on a continuum. You know, a good way to understand it is, you know, maybe somebody comes to the sport quite late in life. You know, they have a somewhat athletic background, but they come to triathlon late in life. They're not, you know, they haven't particularly been particularly active, but, you know, they have talent, for want of a better phrase. You know, really at that point, do you even need to get into the weeds of very specific physiological aspects of development when really you just need to get them fitter? You know, you just need to increase their VO2 max, you know. So rather than worrying about, you know, do we focus on developing their threshold? Do we focus on developing their lactate metabolism? Do we, you know, those are two mechanisms that a coach might consider. But in reality, with this individual, you just need to throw, you know, a varied amount of stimulus at this individual that's early on in their developmental phase, and let them just train consistently, you know, under a variety of stimuli.
Yeah, that might sound very simple. Just train. Maybe hard sometimes. What are the challenges with this, if any? Like, is there a catch?
Yes. I mean, I think you can't get away from some basic rules of thumb of development. So, you know, I've always used over the years, I've always used this analogy of, you know, about being the own architecture, being the own architect of your own house. And so, you know, what I'm talking about there is, you know, the foundations of your house are, you know, your genetics, which you don't have much choice in, your sleep, you know, patterns, your nutrition patterns, your stress management patterns. And then, you know, the walls of the house, if you're trying to build yourself a mansion, you know, you want big, strong walls. You know, that's your structural stability. That's your conditioning status or developmental needs. Some people need to do plenty of conditioning work. Other people, based on, you know, age, sporting background, maybe don't at that point. You know, and then you're getting into, you know, okay, well, how high is the roof? You know, that's the VO2. You know, do we need to raise that in order to have a bigger house? And that simple model is just a snapshot of, you know, where an individual is at. And then, you know, you're very simplistically saying, well, okay, where do they want to be? So if they have a race in 6 months or 12 months, then you almost are wanting to do a gap analysis and say, okay, well, where does this individual want to be, you know, in 6 months, in 12 months? And it might be something as etherous as fitter, faster, stronger. And that's great. And that can really drive some decision-making in the coaching, but it might also be extremely specific. Like, you know, I want to be able to swim this time. I want to be able to bike at this pace. You know, I want to be able to run at this pace. And so that sets, you know, that sets a pathway in place for a process of development for a coach or an athlete to then say, okay, well, that's where I want to be. You know, where am I now? So yes, initially it sounds very simple. But once you start to sort of go under the water of the tip of the iceberg, you know, there's a lot of things to look at. But generally, you know, early in the developmental cycle, you know, you're really concerned about central adaptation. So just improving fitness.
Yeah. So I want to go into that a little bit because you're still talking about things like central adaptations. So we're still looking at components of a system rather than just the outputs of the system or the system as a whole. So what is it that has changed in your coaching in a way, or since starting to look at this sort of model athletes as a complex system, if you're still looking at the components of the physiology, what in practice is the difference between how you used to coach and how you coach now?
I think the biggest difference is contextualizing the workouts to maybe the adaptation that we're chasing after or the scenarios that we expect to happen. So, you know, I can give you a couple examples then that make it a lot easier to understand. So, you know, traditionally within coaching, you know, we may have started from a base point of, okay, we want to do a block of sort of VO2 max development work. And, there's fairly, you know, standardized structures of those types of main set that many, many, many coaches, yourself and me, you know, have used and do use. But then what I felt was more appropriate with more seasoned individuals and elites is to say, okay, well, we want to do this particular stimulus for a given reason. But actually what we should say is we want to do a certain amount of work at very high intensity. And we want to have a certain amount of recovery from that work to elicit a certain metabolic response. But rather than write a session based on pace or intensity, I would say, right, you know, Mikhail, you're in a race scenario, you're on the run, there's four other guys running with you, and you know, you've got 5K to go. You've got four opportunities to drop them one at a time. And I want you to go, to attack each of them for certain, you know, for whatever you feel is necessary. But in total, you're only going to do, for argument's sake, 16 minutes of attacks. And then you're allowed to sit in and recover for eight. But in that 16 minutes, you need to, in your head, visualize those competitors and visualize, you know, dropping them one at a time. So I haven't given you a pace. I haven't given you an interval length. I haven't given you a recovery length. I've given you the autonomy to do all of that. And I've contextualized it in a way that you may even have experienced in a race in the past, or that we may have discussed as a likely outcome in a race that you do in the future.
Yeah. It gives a lot of autonomy and you don't necessarily need the same amount of structure as those typical workouts that we've all seen many, many times would provide.
And it tallies with, you know, maybe how as coaches we need to understand not necessarily the actual age of an individual, but their sort of their athletic age. Because when somebody comes to a coach, you know, very early on in their sporting career, whether they're you know, a junior athlete or whether they're in their 20s, but they're very new to the sport, then, you know, clearly any instruction is going to be very pedagogical. It's going to be very teacher-led. You know, the coach is going to be designing the learning process, giving, you know, tips and guidelines on how to execute that process, providing motivation, you know, setting clear boundaries and clear goals. As you get more experience, that becomes more self-directed learning. And so, you know, I set, as a coach, I might set the task, but I'd encourage you to problem solve that task through a multitude of mechanisms that allow you to kind of learn and experience, you know, your own, you know, sense of awareness of what you're doing and how you're doing it. And then, you know, eventually when somebody is extremely experienced, and this is almost the case with, you know, world-class athletes, you're into the realms of like self-determined learning. So that's very much where the athlete is trying to find problems and then turning to the coach and saying, this is a problem. Just figure out how I resolve that problem. And then, you know, I will then use the tools that I have available to me in a physiological or psychological sense to, you know, implement that solution that you present. So the coach is almost not coming at an elite athlete with, I have a system and I have an approach that I think you need to do. It's more a case of saying, you know, okay, you always seem, just as an example, you know, you always seem to, you know, execute a race where in the swim, first 400 meters, you know, you're right up there with the front pack, almost one of the first swimmers. And then, you know, at 600 meters, you're in the second pack, and then at, you know, 1K into the half Ironman, you're swimming with the third pack. And they're like, you know, I'm training really hard, and my, you know, training's going well, but I don't understand why that's happening. You know, and then that's where I, as a coach, you would go away and say, okay, I'm now into sort of failure management rather than success management, which is what you're doing in the early days of somebody's developmental cycle, is, you know, you're focusing on the principles and practices that are going to create success. But then when somebody is already successful, you're really into the territory of failure management and saying, what goes wrong? Because nobody ever really has the perfect race. So it's like, what went wrong in that race? What went wrong in that race? What went wrong in that training session? You know, what went wrong in that training session? And problem solving. And that's where this sort of complexity comes from.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective, and I like that with how early on in development phase you're thinking of more in terms of success management and then failure management as you get to the very pointy end. One thing that the example with the workout made me think of, where the athlete gets the autonomy to execute a certain scenario, for example, that you described, is that what it makes me think of is that this is sort of an integrated approach where you're working whatever the physiological target of the workout may be, but you're also doing that while practicing the same mental and cognitive skills you will be needing in a race, because we all know that a race is not just about who can score the highest on a VO2 max test, but there are many other components of it. So is that a key part for you?
I think the key part of it is also about helping an athlete understand their own unique physiology. You know, there are athletes out there that are innately predisposed to do well in a race that requires a lot of surging, just because of tactics and strategy and people doing silly things and not doing silly things, and you know, or that there's a lot of surging required because of the nature of the course. You know, it's got lots of punchy climbs, there's headwinds, there's tailwinds. And there are other people who are sort of physiologically predisposed to just need to just sort of be really as even with their effort as possible in order to optimize their physiological performance. And I think the more that you play around with this sort of constraints-based training, the more learning opportunities that you give athletes to, you know, get an insight into, you know, what works best for them. And there's always going to be failure in these types of workouts, but we also know from research on sort of constraints-led training that if athletes are sort of failing at a given task 30% of the time, then you're on the cusp of adaptation and development to that task stimulus. You know, more than that, if they're failing 50% of the time, you know, let's say you give them an interval workout and they just can never get through even half of it, then, you know, you either don't understand their physiology or they're just not, you know, maybe they're not at a point in terms of their development to be able to achieve what you're trying to give them from a race scenario.
If in these workouts that are constraints based, if you don't necessarily give a pace or power target to the athlete, how do you determine that it is a failed or successful workout? Is it when the athlete themselves come to the conclusion that, oh, I was supposed to do 4 surges within this block, but I only managed 3 and then I was absolutely smashed. I just couldn't do anything that would look even remotely surge-like. Or is there? Do you have any other definitions of what
success and failure is? I think that's a good way of looking at it. And it's not failure in the sense that you failed, I'm disappointed. It's failure in a sense of, you know, you failed and there's a learning opportunity there. You know, why did you fail? Well, clearly you failed because when we dig into it, we can see that, you know, the paces that you went out at in the first 3 efforts were so hard that basically you had nothing left in the tank. And so actually, if you did that workout again, you know, you might sort of put a cap on just quite how hard you go on those attacks. So, you know, my ultimate goal with the athletes that I work with is letting them walk into a race, you know, with, you know, a pair of kings, a pair of queens, and a jack, and knowing that that's their poker hand. You know, I'm not, well, that's maybe not as great a hand as you could have, but you get my point. You know, I want athletes to know the hand that they can play or know the game that they can play, because, you know, we as coaches can sit there and say, you know, the optimal way to execute a long distance race is to swim as evenly as possible and bike as evenly as possible and run as evenly as possible. But as you well know from your own experience, you know, once you're at the pointy end, you're not necessarily given that privilege. It's kind of taken away from you by the racing dynamics around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one thing that that this topic and the discussions we've had about it before has always led me to think that it is in some way, and it's not as simplistic as that necessarily, but a lot of it speaks for an approach where race specificity seems to be quite central, even though it doesn't mean that, well, okay, I have this one power target or one power pace, but as you said, it's race specificity within certain scenarios that you might encounter on race.
And you know, and you bring up a really interesting point there about race specificity, because this is what I'm driving at when I say that whilst coaching in the early stages can be very reductionist in its views, you know, over time it needs to be more complex, because when you talk about that race specificity, you and I both know that, you know, that the internet tells us that, you know, the optimal power to race an Ironman at on the bike is 75% of your FTP. Now, I'm not going to get into debates whether that's true or not, but let's just take it as read that it is. But what that misses is we can do all the training in the world to ensure that that from an FTP and percentage of FTP perspective, that you could ride at that power. And, you know, we could validate that within training sessions as well. But what we might actually be missing is the fact that you know, the underlying metabolic cost of you doing that is not fuelable. So actually, whilst you might be trying to ride at 240 watts, just picking a number, in an Ironman, you know, maybe for Mikhail, because of the training that we've done and your own physiology, maybe the price of that is 135 grams of carbohydrate an hour being burnt. And you can't eat that, you can't fuel that. So whilst you could maybe eat 100 or 110 and have a good bike, when you get on the run, you know, sort of metabolically speaking, you're bankrupt. And so that's where I think specificity is important, but it can also take you down a slippery slope of not performing to your ability.
Yeah. For self-coached athletes, what are some tips that you would tell them in terms of, like, especially if you're saying that earlier on in the development cycle, you might use a more traditional approach and benefit from it. But if we have some advanced self-coached athletes, would you be able to give them some advice for how to start integrating this kind of thinking in their training?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I would say start to contextualize some of your quality workouts around, you know, race experiences that have gone well or have gone poorly. You know, there's a dearth of data that we can have to hand nowadays. You know, actually play around with you know, scenarios where you say, okay, well, I did this race like 6 months ago, and you know, I raced really well, and I just don't understand why you know, halfway through the run the lights went out, even though I didn't sort of biomechanically feel I was in a bad place. And that, you know, is one way you might say, okay, well, was I actually getting enough hydration and nutrition on board? Or, you know, was I actually riding far too stochastically for my own ability? And that's where you might experiment and say, well, you know, in that race I started and the run, and you know, I wanted to run at 4.5 minutes per K, just picking a number. And but then after, you know, after 30 minutes, I had to dramatically slow down. And so then, you know, you might precede that with a bike session where you know, ride very steady, and or you ride very stochastically, or you might precede it with a workout where you ride very steady and try and take on board more fuel, and then, you know, run and just pay attention to how your body feels, and how you respond to those changes in principles and practices. And then, you know, if you find a solution that works, that changes the problem, that fixes the problem, then go away and practice it.
So a big takeaway seems to be this iterative learning process. You have had a race experience or several race experiences in the past that you draw upon, but then every time you do a key workout, you have the opportunity to gain these new learning experiences, and also these sessions are in some way designed to help you get through your next race in an optimal manner. But you can basically, you have your starting point, which is way back in your previous races, and then you have your journey through the workouts, and then you have your next endpoint, which is the upcoming A races that you might have, and then throughout the sessions, it's not just about designing your perfect training plan to take you from point A to point B, but to really be present through that journey and change things as you get new information coming in. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of it is around mindset. I mean, let's not forget that the nature of this sport is that really the absolute majority of the training needs to be aerobically orientated. You know, what we're really, you know, I'm not talking about the steak, you know, I'm talking, you know, what we're really talking about is, you know, the vegetables on the plate. You know, the steak is just solid aerobic work. You know, you're not, this isn't like an advocacy for, you know, just doing, you know, high intensity interval training or CrossFit to get you through an Ironman. You know, there's a reality to a certain amount of aerobic work being required. But this is sort of more the nuance around how to develop yourself as an athlete in the context of racing and intensity within your training.
Yeah. One of the things that one of the papers that we've discussed talks about is developing diversity potential as well.
Yes.
And I think that's quite an interesting concept to think of in terms of, again, one example that comes to mind personally is that, well, traditionally, a lot of the race specificity might be oriented towards one specific steady power, and you go out and do 4x25 minutes for your half distance race pace or race power on the bike, or 3x50 minutes or an hour for your Ironman race pace or whatever it may be. But that's not necessarily developing your diversity potential, but it's about maybe being able to do a hard 10-minute effort first because you have a climb at the start of the bike, and then being able to do that work afterwards.
Yes, and you're always trying to make sure you're not doing anything too extravagant. But the reality is, if you dial into a very specific pace or power, and, you're operating at certain muscular contraction rates, and then you go out in the real world and you ride on a course where there's wind, there's gradient changes, and so actually you're constantly having to adapt. Well, it's better to have prepared for that scenario. So, a very simple one is the swim. If somebody naturally prefers quite a low stroke rate in the swim, but they're actually quite fit, then when they go and race, they find themselves in the midst of a pack. They're swimming on somebody else's feet. The water that they're trying to catch is, less aerated. It's less dense. So their hand is slipping through the water a lot quicker. So their stroke count, their stroke rate goes up. And that's something that they're not used to muscularly. And so whilst the fitness is there, it's almost like the capacity for the chassis to express the fitness is lacking. And it's this kind of problem solving that you're always trying to wrap your head around and do when you're thinking about things as like complex systems, rather than, as you say, I'm going to ride my Ironman at this power. I'm going to go out and do 4x20 minutes at that power, and then I'm golden.
Yeah. And even something as simple as thinking about where you do it, like if you do that, those 4x20 minutes outdoors, that's still going to be more realistic in terms of how that might happen on race day compared to doing it indoors on the trainer, which is not to say that that's a bad way to train at all. I love it, but it's just a very different experience to being able to produce power outdoors. Yeah. and being able to sort of work with the terrain and work with the small changes or bigger changes that comes up depending on the course you're riding.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, certainly, this isn't, as well, this isn't like that we're trying to reinvent the wheel. I think it's an iteration of sort of coaching and athlete development that's been sort of coming for a long time across a multitude of sports. Soccer is probably a prime, or soccer, football, whatever you want to call it. It's a prime example of where there's been so much research done in player development and talent development. And and yet you hear these stories of, I'm going to kind of pick one country, but how, talent comes out of Brazil, and it's because these kids are growing up playing, small-sided games in, constrained spaces on uneven surfaces, with different size goals, different weight ball, in favelas or suburbs of cities. And that's actually creating so much diversity in the stimuli that they're getting that then when they go into a more structured environment, it's almost like they've got, so many different coloring in pencils that actually, shading something in black or shading something in blue is just really easy to do. Whereas I think in a Western you know, in more Western civilizations, we've always tried to work out in coaching, in many sports, you know, well, what's the right crayon to use at the right point? And yet we are learning more and more. You know, you look at sports in the US, all the top NFL selections every year at the draft, at the combine, more and more and more you're seeing, you know, athletes, you know, that are the top picks, you know, also talking about how they excelled in baseball and basketball and track and field when they were high school kids, and high school's all the way up to 18. And so what that's telling you is just diversity and a broad range of stimuli is ultimately what works best. And there isn't an exact formula for that. It's, you know, it's not like you must use these different stimuli to create good athletes. It's just athletes need to be presented with lots of opportunities, and there'll always be athletes that will stand out from the crowd. You know, Tiger Woods is the classic example of, you know, was swinging a golf club when he was a tiny baby before he could even walk properly. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got, Rafael Nadal, who didn't really get into tennis until he was a teenager.
Yeah, for listeners that like reading or like books, David Epstein's Range is a fantastic book that talks about this. I think the football example is really, really interesting. I used to play football for a long time as a kid, and the comparison you make there between the Western football development system and Brazil, where it happens organically and in an unstructured way. What we used to do was passing drills, shooting drills, defense drills, all sorts of things, really, and of course there were some small-sided games and just normal game time, but I think that it was definitely quite a structured way of learning, trying to break the game down into different subcomponents. But that didn't mean, obviously, we were nowhere near as technically proficient or proficient to anything as like these kids coming out of Brazil usually. So I think that's a really good example of how an integrated approach and not necessarily the most structured approach can be a really good approach still in terms of developing performance potential and the performance potential in a diverse set of conditions as well. So that was one thing. Yeah, sorry, go on.
And that's, you know, it's a good point that you make about, you know, a lack of structure, and it can, don't get me wrong, it, you know, it can backfire. You know, you do get some athletes who you present them with a training session where there's a quite a significant amount of autonomy, and they just go, well, I'm just going to do this workout that you gave me in the past that's really, really, really structured and specific because that's just what ticks the box for me mentally. And that's fine, because I also, as a coach, I think that can start to tell you a lot about an athlete. That, okay, well, actually, you know, the area of development for this athlete is coping with chaos, is coping with complexity, which they might encounter in a race scenario. And it's, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about, you know, stochastic racing or complexity or chaos in racing, in races that take you know, anywhere from 3 hours and 40 minutes to 16 hours, but the reality is those things do still occur, and they just occur in different ways for different athletes at different stages of development. You know, for an athlete that's very new to the sport and is just trying to get round their first Ironman, the complexity is the terrain and the weather conditions and the wind and the hydration, and you know, those are the complexity factors for them. For an elite, you know, it there's even more.
Yeah, I think one of the things that stand out to me as well is that, I guess as a society and in triathlon, we have a very typical sort of demographic, both in terms of nationalities, but also in terms of personality types that are attracted to triathlon. And I think a lot of us are really, we like some sort of certainty or predictability. And I guess that's not maybe unique to triathlon. Yeah. It's for humankind, but also in some ways it's a false sense of certainty that we think that we have a certain plan laid out, a certain like really rigid structure to something, and we think that okay, if we can diligently follow this, then we will be at exactly ABC fitness on race day and be able to do whatever performance we have been aiming towards. And sometimes maybe it's better to be uncomfortable about having uncertainty and accepting that we have uncertainty and how things will go, rather than be like having a false sense of certainty, but actually being wrong about how that certainty exists in a plan, because it really doesn't. Like it is so interdependent, all the things related to developing performance potential, because it's not just physiology, it's psychology and cognitive skills and being able to,
and social, you know, social pressures, backgrounds, all those things. And that's what's really interesting is, you know, one of the papers that, you know, we were looking at, you know, it highlighted this point about, you know, that, you know, the real true champions, you know, are differentiated by the mindset that they bring to the, you know, to a situation, to a, you know, a sporting trauma, to a complexity, to a chaotic situation. It's the mindset that they bring to it. It's not the experience and as a result, wisdom that they have from prior occurrences. And I think that's really interesting, is that you know, whether you're a novice athlete or whether you're, you know, a top age grouper or whether you're a world-class elite, what you really want to be thinking about is, what do I take away from every experience that I have in a training session or in a race? You know, what do I take away as a, what went well, you know, what is an area of development, or what is a, I'm just scratching my head and I've got no idea what went on. And then, you know, whether you have people around you that can help resolve those things, or whether, you know, you can do that yourself just by reflecting on that experience. That's where the real growth and success occurs with, you know, with any athlete.
Yeah, that they talked about proactive coping mechanisms versus being reactive, and I think that's something that blends nicely with what we talked about with reflection and learning from session to session. For example, if you go out and do a long key workout, a key ride, for example, and you end up bonking, for example, then like, being proactive about that. Okay, this happened now. How do I make sure that it doesn't happen in the race? What can I do differently, rather than just being reactive? And on when it happens on race day, you start to think, oh, I really need to do something about this because this ruined my race. But yeah, that being a differentiating factor between the true champions and the others was really interesting. And that, something we can all learn from.
And that proactivity, you know, it applies to everything that you know interconnects with performance. You know, when we think of you know, the some of the things that female athletes have to deal with, you know, I make an effort to understand, you know, how the menstrual cycle impacts on lactate metabolism, how it impacts on carbohydrate metabolism, how it impacts on hemodynamics. And I listened to a really interesting presentation the other day, and the research scientist there was talking about how, you know, we definitely are aware of this subject in female sports, in, you know, women's basketball, women's soccer, and it's something that teams and professional organizations are beginning to ensure that there's appropriate education in place for the players and the staff. But they made a really interesting point that, you know, the research at the moment has said, okay, well, you know, maybe this is an optimal point in an athlete's, in a female athlete's cycle to race, when in fact what we should be doing is saying, what does this athlete need to do the rest of the time to ensure that they can race and perform to the best of their ability pretty much whenever? And I thought that was a really interesting point that they were making, and saying then, you know, because you know the menstrual cycle can have very different impacts on different females, there may be different ways that they have to approach it from a recovery perspective or a nutrition perspective. And so, you know, I've personally had athletes that have gone through an entire season of racing and been in a situation where 50% of their goal races are absolutely right where they don't want the race to be. And lo and behold, those races were never their best performances. Now on reflection, you know, I would look back at you know, that situation sort of several years ago and say it would have been really nice to know that actually maybe we could have done things in terms of nutritional strategies, actually day to day, week to week, that change week on week, that actually help that athlete perform to their best of their ability. So that, you know, that's an example of sort of thinking outside the box about factors that impact on performance and managing those in a proactive way that's going to actually improve an athlete's ability to perform.
Yeah, that's a fantastic example. You mentioned earlier that we shouldn't try to reinvent the wheel. Can you maybe just recap some of the things that you still think it's important? Like, in what sense is it still important to perhaps think about the components of the system of the athlete as a single system and try to develop certain components? To what extent do you think it still makes sense to do that?
I mean, I think the easiest way to look at that is firstly to say, if you're very early on in your athletic career as a triathlete, and I'm going to stick with triathlon and specifically long distance triathlon, or somebody that's maybe new to the sport and doing an Olympic distance race or even a sprint distance race. But if you're very new to the sport, your main concern should not be, you know, the minutiae of, you know, what heart rate zone do I need to do my training in? What's my threshold? I think that you want to get a broad range of experience in training stimuluses that keep you active, keep you training consistently, and broaden your experience and awareness of what you're doing and how it feels. And then as you become more and more experienced, you know, you can start to develop, you know, really deep training loads in certain territories to address certain developmental needs. You know, like, if, for instance, if you've decided to do an Ironman and you've never done one before, then clearly there's going to be a big developmental need to do a lot more aerobic work. And, you know, basic principles that you can't avoid, I think, are, you know, I won't go as far to say that, you know, polarized 80-20 training is the be-all and end-all, but there definitely needs to be a large percentage of your training that is very aerobically orientated, because that's the nature of the racing that we do. And then everything after that is sort of contextual to your development needs and the racing that you're going to do. So a good example that I use in that is that if somebody has decided to do a half Ironman that's really, really hilly and hot, and they live somewhere that's in the northern hemisphere and very flat, then you definitely need to get creative around working out how you're going to excel in that very different environment.
Yeah, that's a great summary. And well, one thing that I also wanted to ask you is if you feel that, and I kind of touched upon this earlier, but do you feel that we generally have perhaps an overly confident view in like a very rigid structured approach, or and not really, but lacking maybe some creativity, for lack of a better word, in how we design training and how we go about executing the training as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think coaches, and I'm included in this, I'm not sat here being all high and mighty. I think for many years we've chased after the sort of perfect periodization. And there isn't really the perfect periodization. You know, there's, some athletes will need certain amounts of rest on certain intervals than others. Some individuals need to be a lot more careful with, you know, high mileage running than others. So I think trying to figure out the perfect solution is not a great place to be nowadays as a coach. Whereas I think understanding basic principles and, you know, the fact that you want to create the ability to move well before you want to create the ability to move well, you know, at high speed and power, before you create the ability to move well at high speed and power for a long period of time. You know, I don't think you can suddenly jump to the end of that analogy and expect people to excel.
Yeah, I think that is a great take. And in addition to searching for the perfect periodization, these days I think we see a lot of discussions around what is the perfect training intensity distribution. Also, what is the perfect workout to improve this and that, or the perfect workouts. And I think that's something that our discussions over the last couple of months around this topic has made me think about a lot, in terms of like really not looking so much for perfection in any way. But also when I started thinking about that, I started thinking about, why is it that we always look for the perfect solution for a physiological problem when physiology is not the only thing that matters when it comes to race performance?
And exactly.
And I kind of think that we tend to maybe sometimes overestimate physiology, and we don't pay as much attention as we should to things like psychology.
No, I mean, you're absolutely spot on. And, you know, with the situation that we've been in, I say we, I don't mean the royal we, you and I just mean generally as society, with COVID, over the last year, what we've seen is, the evolution of changes in athlete adaptation due to the sort of, you know, the mental fatigue of training for long periods of time without a known sort of line in the sand in terms of when they're racing, and, you know, or having to train in a sort of a lockdown type scenario and not knowing when that's going to end. And so you can have the perfect training plan for the circumstances, but if you discount the fact that it might be mentally really taxing under those circumstances that it's being executed, then you find yourself in a situation where you're scratching your head and going, well, why didn't I get the adaptation that I was expecting? And so, you know, one research scientist I know, who's also a coach to world-class athletes, uses this phrase of sort of psychosocial biological performance. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. And depending on the individual, you may weight certain aspects of that phraseology in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start to wrap up. Can you give us maybe two or three practical takeaways that you want to leave the listeners with?
I think the biggest I would say is, you know, as an athlete that's looking to develop, really try to reflect on the experiences that haven't gone well in training or racing, and ask yourself, well, why didn't those go well? And if you can't sort of deductively reason why that is, then, you know, certainly find somebody or look for information on figuring that out, because that's where I think the real opportunities lie in any athlete's development. And those things do evolve. It's not like you fix one thing and then, you know, you have the most perfect race ever. It's like you fix one thing and then something else crops up. And you fix something else and then something else crops up. And as long as you're happy on that journey of being sort of proactively reflective, you'll always continue to improve and develop as an athlete. And that's the biggest takeaway I would give, you know, everyone.
Right. Yeah. And then I'll just chime in with mine, which I probably would say that for me, it's to train according to different scenarios that you might encounter on race day, and make sure that you add that in and get a relatively frequent exposure to that sort of training, and making sure that it's trying to get a diverse set of that as well, and not having sort of too many constrained preconceived notion of what the race is going to look like, because it's unlikely that you can that you're able to go at a super steady 250 watts for the entire race, but really think about, well, what is this race actually going to look like, and what can potentially happen that I might not have thought about yet, but training for that as well.
And I'd add to that statement of yours that, you know, those constraints to the training, you know, might also be environmentally driven or competitor driven, based on one's experience or one's intentions of racing. So going back to that example of, you know, terrain, course, heat, humidity, wind, I know all of these things you can get creative around figuring ways to develop awareness of what those environments are going to feel like, not only just the racing intensity and how that executes.
Yeah, that's really great, and really agree with that. Finally, we have discussed a few papers that we've looked at, and I will link to them all in the show notes for this episode, so you don't need to mention them here specifically, because they will be there and I can mention them in the outro of the episode. Is there anything else that I'm not aware of that you have looked at that you would consider a good recommended resource on the topic for people interested in learning more and reading more?
I mean, I think going back to the psychology of racing, I think a really good resource that's been on my radar for a long time, and I've actually had, you know, quite a few athletes turn to it recently, particularly because of sort of the COVID situation has sort of made them really sort of look at what's driving them to perform, and that's Carol Dweck's book, Growth Mindset.
Yeah, that's a good recommendation. I think one thing that is a bit sort of vague and unstructured is I find that listening to interviews with pro athletes is quite intriguing, in that you don't always get the specific training program or anything, and that's not necessarily that's not what I listen to those interviews for anyway. But hearing the stories can actually help you get some, if nothing else, motivation, but also inspiration to how to do small changes and tweaks to your training yourself. I remember, for example, an anecdote from Alistair Brownlee when preparing for the London 2012 Olympics. On a podcast, he was saying how every single run, and I'm not sure if he meant every single hard run or every single run period, he ended with a 100-meter all-out sprint, because he thought that was what the race is going to end like, and he just was really prepared for that. And I think that, well, pro athletes, that they maybe don't do everything right, but there are things that we can learn from them, and so just listening to that and with an open mind, I think, and maybe trying some things out and see if it works for you and your scenario, that can be another interesting resource.
Yeah, I think the point that you raised about certainty is a really key one. You know, one of the particularly sort of top track and field coach that I know uses this analogy, and I think it's a good one, of the, you know, in terms of their coaching, 80% of what they advise is sort of wisdom based. 20% is sort of experimental, based on sort of intuition and research. And then 5% is pure guesswork. And I think, you know, when you've got world-class coaches saying that, then, you know, it kind of reminds you that it's not necessarily good to chase after certainty in what you're doing, because it just doesn't exist. And I think when you look at professional athletes as well, you know, I would caution that sometimes the impression you can get is that what's worked for the, you know, the mechanisms by which this person has become world class, you know, are things that I can apply. And the reality is invariably not that. And there's a really good book by a guy called Todd Rose called Dark Horse. And that's a really great read around actually getting to the top in whatever endeavor it is that you're choosing to pursue can actually be pretty messy, pretty chaotic, and involve quite a lot of failure. And so we have to caution ourselves at taking, you know, a sort of a rose-tinted view of a particular athlete's journey to success and saying, oh, that's what, you know, we should all be doing in training. Because the reality is that's probably maybe like a tenth or a quarter of what is actually relevant.
Yes, no, that is absolutely true, for sure. And it all needs to be considered on an individual level and applied, I guess, scaled or adjusted for what the individual's goals are and ability level. All right. So, David, where can people follow you and what you got going on? Do you have any?
I think probably the on Instagram, Coach Tilbers is where I post. I'm not prolific on social media. And, you know, certainly if people are interested in what some of the athletes I work with are doing, there's, you know, I'm going to have plenty of athletes racing at St. George 70.3 in a few weeks, where I'll have Alyssa Dala, Leslie Smith, Kayla Cabellin, Lionel Sanders, Bart Ehnerts, all racing, and then at Ironman Tulsa as well. Quite a few of those individuals will be racing there. Kim Morrison as well, who just had a really good race at Galveston. Those are probably, you know, if you're looking to see what some of the athletes are doing, those would be two races to follow and look at what they're up to.
Great. Yeah, good luck to all of them. All right, that's it. Thank you so much for coming on and having a chat. I very much appreciate it, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Take care.
I hope that you enjoyed that discussion with Coach David Tilbury Davis. I want to make some commentary here at the end of the episode. David and I are both very aware that this episode is quite a bit different than what we've done in the past. And honestly, it's very different to any episode I've ever done on this podcast, I would say. So as I said at the beginning, it can take some time to digest this information and let it take that time, maybe listen to it again. But I think that it can open up your mind and your thoughts and make you think about things. And that's the goal of it at the end of the day. A couple of points that I want to highlight here before we wrap up is that we're talking about an evolution in coaching and training, not revolution, not radical change and throwing everything out and starting from scratch. We're essentially just describing one particular framework or a set of frameworks that can be complementing the traditional style of endurance training. It's not a binary choice between completely different approaches. It's another tool in the toolbox. So in your evolution as a coach or as a self-coached athlete, perhaps. Another thing that I want to discuss is that if you think that we were a bit vague in this discussion, then you are probably right. And there are several reasons for this. First of all, we decided to have this be an organic discussion rather than the more typical interview style that I normally do. And that meant a lot of jumping back and forth between topics for good and for bad. And the good part, I think, about this was that we really managed to avoid, I think, all or almost all jargon that could easily have worked its way in if we had discussed this from an interview perspective, maybe discussing things that we can find in the literature and so on. But on the flip side, maybe it was a bit unstructured, or it definitely was more unstructured than a normal interview. So that may cause it to be a bit more vague in that sense. But hopefully we provided enough examples to highlight some of the key points anyway. Another thing that I think is important to note is that we definitely don't pretend to have all the answers or have a guidebook or a formula to coaching or training. And I mean, these particular topics or frameworks of training that we discussed here, David has been exploring these topics in both practice and in theory for many months already. I'm personally far behind his level of expertise, but even if we had both had years to work on it, the episode might still have sounded the same, because an important part of this evolution of coaching that we're describing is that the role of the coach can be seen as co-discovering with the athlete and not just be there to provide solutions, but be there to discover with the athlete, together with the athlete, and also be the one who designs a learning environment for the athlete. But then the athlete and the constraints that the environment poses, they become really, the athlete finds their own solutions within that constraints-based learning approach. So it's very much iterative and depending on the athlete feedback from the coach's roles perspective. And just to finalize with one more thing that I already mentioned, but the purpose of this discussion is simply to make you think and reflect. So if our discussion achieved that, then in my mind, it served its purpose. And it probably will be the kind of episode that many listeners might not find very interesting or useful or practical. But I hope and believe that for maybe a smaller group of listeners, that it can be really, really unique and eye-opening and perhaps one of the best episodes they've ever listened to. So I hope that it maybe achieved that for a smaller group of listeners. As always, you can find the show notes for today's episode on scientifictriathlon.com with links to David's past appearances on the podcast and also a number of research papers for those curious to dig into the literature. Just a word of warning that some of them are quite jargon heavy. That's not to discourage you from reading them, but it's just to say that if you don't immediately recognize how they relate to what we discussed in this episode, it's because we tried to cut out all the jargon from our discussion. If you just want to get a high-level summary, then I think that the paper that I linked to by Paul and colleagues has two tables, table 1 and 2, that provide a great summary of some of the things in these types of coaching and training frameworks. On Thursday, we have another TTS Thursday episode coming out, and then next Monday, there will be an interview, as usual, with a guest who is still to be confirmed at the moment of recording this segment. So, yeah, just stay subscribed, or subscribe if you are not already, so that you don't miss any future episodes. And finally, remember that we are now in the launch period of the newly launched Advanced Olympic Half and Full Distance Training Plans. So for a limited period, you can get these plans for 60% off their regular price. This period lasts until the 30th of April of 2021 with the promo code ADVANCED at checkout on the Training Peaks page for each plan. You can find all the links to the plan versions and all the information and the code, etc., on scientifictriathlon.com on the training plans page. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and get a free hydration strategy and get 15% off your order with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.